being that a lot of members of the staff up here are teachers in one form or another, are going to be teachers, we thought maybe tonight it might be interesting to talk about education in America today. A lot of ways it's in pretty bad shape. The way I look at it sometimes, I think it's in pretty bad shape altogether. I'm sort of the head dishwasher up there. You have the head dishwasher leading them, so. But I have a degree in education. Did my student teaching in a Negro school in Toledo, 100% Negro. And I worked as a teacher day in Toledo Public School, and I've been tutoring for a couple of years, and I've also worked in reading improvement center at the University of Toledo. And I thought a couple of things tonight, develop a little discussion tonight, is that over 12 years ago, when the Supreme Court outlawed segregated schools. But the 1964 Civil Rights Act required a report to be made. And the outcome of this report was that our schools today, and this report has been updated within the last year even, that our schools today are more segregated than they were when the Supreme Court had this decision of Brown versus Pico, which outlawed segregated schools. Our schools in the United States actually today are more segregated than they were when the Supreme Court outlawed. Also, the Civil Rights, the Civil Rights Acts that were going around, but in 65, this education bill passed, and this required a report to be made dealing with Negro and white students. Called the Coleman Report. One of the basic things coming out of this was that after all other variables were taken out of the study, that Negro children attending white school, their test scores rose, and white children attending Negro school, their test scores stayed the same. And the reasoning behind this was, just figured out, is that the aspiration level, environmental background, the peer group in these schools is what brought up the Negro test score. In other words, this report quite vividly pointed out the fact that we need integrated schools. There's no denying this thing. I have visited schools in City of Chicago, on the South Side, Detroit, and Columbus, and Cincinnati, and from Toledo, so I'm talking about their schools. I thought maybe we could talk about the schools we have in the inner city today, which are basically quite poor, and which in some places, such as New York, the Negroes are saying they do not want even white teachers in these schools anymore. And there's some validity in their statement. I've also seen many Negro teachers, which weren't any good either. Just the general statement that Negro teachers are better for Negro students isn't a very good generalization. Also, the statement that it's heard some places that need more younger teachers is not a very good statement either, because I've seen a good number of older teachers and older principals who had a lot on the ball, were doing a very good job. I know a lot of the students I graduated with from the University of Toledo, quite frankly, if I knew these people were teaching in a school where I had children going, I think I'd take them out of school. I don't think these people are qualified at all to be teaching school. There is one man teaching in the Toledo public school system, who the University of Toledo refuses to accredit, refuses to give their okay for him to be certified by the state of Ohio. He's teaching in the Toledo public school system. The Toledo public school system says they do not have a teacher shortage. But they hire people like this man, and the University of Toledo refuses to give their okay to be certified by the state of Ohio. There's also the fact that in the state of Ohio, teachers have to be certified after they're on a 2-year probationary period. Certification means the teacher is on tenure, and the teacher, quite frankly, it's almost impossible to fire once they're on tenure. As Dr. Beach says, she doesn't know why teachers don't really speak out on more issues and do more things, because she says, you know, except in sexual matters, that's the only thing that gets you fired. Well, I skipped the point. But in the state of Ohio, there are 22,000 teachers who are not certified. There's a state law, there's been a state law for a number of years, teachers in the state of Ohio are certified, but there are 22,000 who are not. I was talking to 3 girls on staff this afternoon who are from North Dakota, and they figure that half of the teachers in South Dakota are not certified. The office of a great number of teachers in South Dakota have only had 2 years of college altogether. I saw people teaching mentally retarded children, either brain damaged or otherwise, in the city of Chicago, who had a college degree. Not even in education, all they had was a degree and who knows what in education, in college education.
Who are you doing your taxes? What, 2,000?
From the Ohio State Department of Education.
Why would they release a figure like that, Raj?
Well, we need teachers. There's no denying this fact. No matter what my grades would have been in college, I, as a man in education, I'm interested in elementary education, from my background in elementary education, I practically could be guaranteed a job. At the present time, I don't have a job in the fall, at the present time. I may still end up going to the Virgin Islands, I don't know yet. But no matter, I can still get a job, if I could get a job as of September 1st, because I am a man, and I'm interested in going into elementary education.
Gone to California, no problem.
I could go to the city of Detroit, which is paying $7,500 starting salary. This fall and next fall, will be starting pay will be $7,800. I could also teach in the city of Toledo, which is paying $5,800. But the thing is, the garbage collectors in the city of Toledo would still be making more money than I would. And someplace along the line, it strikes me as being a little bit funny that the people who pick up your garbage once a week get paid more than the people you turn your kids over to $6 a day for 12 years. I'm not saying my salary at, you know, $5,800 is more than adequate for me, being I'm single. But I should, maybe shouldn't be paid any more than this. What I'm saying is, if you're going to pay the person who picks up your garbage once a week, maybe if you want me to teach your kids something, 6 hours a day, 12, for 12 years, you know, to get the best teachers, maybe you should start paying them a little more. There's a greater increase in men in education today, and one of the reasons for this is that salaries are finally coming up. Within the last 2 years, 2 years ago, there were a great number of school systems in the state of Ohio that did not pay $5,000. I think anyone will realize that a man with a family could not too well support a family if he's not making at least $5,000. For women in education, which we've had a great many of, and we still have a great many of, and we always will, you know, $5,000 or less, and your husband is making the same amount or more, wasn't bad. But now that there is an increase in men, the salaries are going up, and you're also going to see more militancy now that men are getting an education.
I have one question to ask. Has the overhead, the administrative overhead, what figures do you have on the increase of that in the schools, and why?
I don't have any figures, but in several school systems, such as Toledo and Detroit, the number of administrators are going up. We're having more and more government programs, we're having more and more this and that type of programs, we're getting more and more supervisors and administrators, where actually what we need is more teachers.
I'm of that opinion, but I noticed that the overhead of the Bellevue schools, and this may be a better figure to do it for, the overhead has increased practically to get the seating compared to what the teachers get. And I just wondered if there was any earthly reason for it. Outside the parties of the first law or something.
Well, could it be the administrators are working a longer period, say 11 months versus 9?
This might be a possibility. More and more school systems are going into either 10 or 12 month contract. This is another growing trend of having a public school system. There's also some movement afoot some places, and the state of Ohio just passed in a legislation that the school systems can operate 12 months a year if they now desire. And I think this may be a coming thing. We have approximately the same number of high school students going to summer school in the city of Toledo. Let's go to high school, probably what? In other words, there isn't that much drop off. Part of the city of Toledo programs, part of them are tuition paid, part of the kids have to pay themselves.
Why are they going to summer school? Pick up lost credits or more credits?
I think a lot of kids are picking up more things they wouldn't have taken otherwise. More and more kids I'm seeing are getting out of high school, and they're not taking 4 years to get out of high school. A lot of kids are getting bored with high school. I mean, you need 16 units of work in the state of Ohio to get out of high school. And a kid's bored with high school, and I think he has every right to be bored with a lot of high schools, a lot of the things which they're given in high school. A lot of our changes being made in the curriculum and things that come from the elementary school, we haven't really got around to changing the high schools any great extent as of yet, but it's coming.
I think there's time to change in high school, because our school is going on a modular system, and it's new, it's working out. Some parents are disapprove of it, and I think it depends largely upon the student himself, because the classes can be arranged from from 20 minutes to 60 or 90 minutes. And therefore, if they're working on a science project, they schedule their time differently each day, including 60 minutes and 90 minutes on Monday, and therefore they are beginning to feel more and more needed.
This is a structural change or administrative change. A lot of these are good, but one of the problems you run into in making this type of a change is teachers are not the most changeable people in the world. They're not the most flexible people in the world. They're very stuck in their ways. You know, they may have tried something once and they found out that it worked, and they keep trying it, even though their students may change. You know, they found something that worked once and they keep on doing it. And it takes an awful lot to get them to change. Now, this is one of our biggest problems in team teaching or anything, is the friction between the teachers themselves.
Well, it's another thing about modular scheduling is there still has not been a concerted effort on the part of either college people or the high school level to develop curriculums specifically for modular scheduling. And what has often happened is a school goes on modular scheduling and they still keep the same textbook and the same teacher writes the same things on the blackboard, only the kids don't have to spend 50 minutes there to absorb it, or they just spend 20 minutes or something. And it's happened in too many cases. This is not true of all high schools, but it has happened in too many cases.
Well, something that I've seen happening in a few schools is that schools go on modular scheduling, which is designed so that the student day and the school day can be flexible. And too many schools go on a modular scheduling that is just as rigid as the 50-minute period one. And that whole thing is designed so that you can have a flexible day so that teachers and students can change their days around according to what they're doing. And too many people end up with rigid days. And it wasn't the object.
No, but I think that when this modular scheduling is set up by an IBM, for instance, they have a certain amount of periods in which the new material is presented, up to 200 or 400 people. Well, this must be, of course, scheduled, because otherwise you don't get But at the same time, the rest of the day can be scheduled, and there are some students that don't turn up for classes to a great degree, and they miss a lot. So perhaps some of it is self-discipline, self-discipline enough to gain them up. But then would these same students gain anymore in the 50-minute period?
Well, yeah, right. We worry a lot. Well, in many of the schools, you don't have to go to class, or you have free time, and you don't have to go and study. And the public worries a lot about the fact that we have kids milling around, not doing anything. But the thing is that the public doesn't know how many students we had during the 50-minute periods absolutely fogging out. You know, they weren't listening. They weren't there. And who can say but what we were wasting just as much time or more time, even our teachers' time, when people were listening. You know, and now we have them milling around in the school perhaps instead, but people get real worried about that.
To really efficiently work on the system, your ratio should be smaller, but we're still short of teachers, and as a result, we have teachers trying to take a heavy class load. Very difficult in the modular system because we don't have enough personal contact.
You know, you mentioned how many teachers in what one of the COVIDs were inadequately trained. I think we have an opposite kind of thing happening in California, and that is for the last I think maybe 5 years, we've always required 5 years of college for secondary teachers, but now this has been changed to requiring 5 years of education, college education for elementary school teachers. And as a result, and somebody out there can't see, Yale, we'll take you to California. But as a result, we have a terrible shortage in the elementary school. I'm not so convinced that it's necessary to be that highly trained to teach in elementary school. I think maybe some of the classes that they're taking in their 4 years of college for the old type of credential could have been changed to teach them any new kinds of skills that they needed to know, rather than simply adding on another year.
Well, actually, you know, 2 years, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years of college, I'm not too sure, you know, a person, we can run a person through this program, and I'm not too sure we still got to be a teacher.
Right. I think even this is the administration of education colleges is also part of the problem, that they're looking for a job for themselves. Let's give them another course, so let's give them another six-unit course in educational psychology or whatever, and piling it on so that it gets equals to another year of either graduate school or you can call it graduate school. It's not really very much of a graduate program, I don't think. But
one of the biggest problems, I think, in teacher education is the fact that usually, if there's a student teaching or student internship or whatever they call it, this usually doesn't come until your senior year. In other words, you've had 3 years of college, and all of a sudden you're supposed to go out and you're supposed to apply all these things you've learned. Well, yes and no. That depends upon the person you're working with. I went into a situation and I figured that, well, gee, you know, I was supposed to have learned all these things and I was supposed to have been taught all the supposedly the right way of doing things. Well, maybe I should try them out now and, you know, see for myself whether or not they work or if they fail. Well, things just don't work out that way, because the woman I worked with, she believed by going by the book, and I had to do what she wanted. And I did try out very little of what I learned. So a lot of my experiences, I'm afraid, I had to get on my own. My visits to, like, Detroit, where I spent 4 days, I spent a day in each individual school for my teacher's aid job. And I worked all morning in a very well-off elementary school in Cedarsville. I was the only teacher's aide in the whole building. And I had 11 women for my boss. Worked out pretty well. You know, these
things that I had to do all on my own, or that I had to go out and get all this experience on my own, which I think is one of our biggest problems, is the kids aren't out there, you know, as freshmen, they're not out there as sophomores, you know? They're not out there actually seeing what's going on in the school.
We do this now, at least the local college that feeds practice teachers or student teachers, if you want one, into our high schools and junior highs. And they start coming out as freshmen and junior and juniors in college, and in some elementary schools, they use high school seniors to observe and become some kind of teacher assistant. The only difficulty is that the college tends to force these people on you, whether you want them or not. And then you feel that while the administration of the local school says they may not do anything, they must only sit and watch, the college is saying they should do bulletin boards and they should be teaching and they should be doing all these wonderful things. And then you get stuck with having to write some kind of recommendation for these 10 people who are watching all day long. And theoretically, you should be able to weed out the people who aren't, you see, are not going to be very good teachers. But in fact, nobody weeds anybody out because you're afraid, you know, you're kind of afraid because the college is going to say, that school and that teacher is good. So they all come back then.
We need a lot better working relationship between the local universities and colleges of education and the public schools, if you're in the city of Chicago. As far as I can make out, what's called Teachers College South and Teachers College North is more or less administrated or run by the Chicago Board of Education. But the University of Chicago and the Chicago Board of Education, for all intents and purposes, frankly don't even speak to each other. Sort of silly. The only professor, the only man in the past number of years who has graduated from the University of Chicago with a PhD degree, he's worked in the Chicago public school system. There's only one man in a number of years in the Chicago public schools was willing to have the sort of go-between the university and them. He said, that's what he means. Not the University of Toledo, I don't know how I have the most example. And on the city of Toledo, an awful lot of teachers take the attitude of going to some places, so the administrators in the city of Toledo system, that we are doing the college people a favor by taking your students and owing them, you know, the school. And this is very cool. Wayne State University and the Detroit Public School System, I think, have the best working relationship that I have seen in the five cities that I know well from. There are people moving in and out of, professors and students moving in and out of Detroit public schools all the time. There's even high school kids from Burton School, which is the, have you ever seen any pictures of children of poverty as far as being small and dirty and ill clothed and ill, and the building is being dark and dirty and dingy? This is Burton School in Detroit. If anybody knows anything about Detroit, it's only a block north of the Masonic Temple. And just a little bit south of Wayne State University, the Detroit Institute of Art, and all these other things. And at this school, the kids in the local high school are coming in on their study halls and helping tutoring individual students. And it was a very good relationship all around. Talking about high school, I have some really strong feelings about high school, even though I'm not really involved in them. A couple of things I have about high schools is that I honestly believe the high school has any right to dictate to the boys how long their hair should be. I don't believe that the high school has any right to dictate to the girls how short their skirt should be. And I also believe that if there's going to be a rule in the public high schools that there is no smoking for the students, this should go for everybody. Because I know the high school I went to, you opened up the door to the teacher's lounge, and the teachers went back, and the smoke poured out. We're going to make a rule that it should apply to everybody, not just the students. If there's no smoking in the high school, there's no smoking, period.
the teachers can smoke, I think the kids can smoke if they don't want to.
Oh, aren't there certain privileges and responsibilities to grow with getting older? I mean, I
We always take law that we smoke.
There's an awful lot of 18-year-old high school students, an awful lot.
Yeah, but if they're under the jurisdiction, they're still in high school, so therefore they're under the jurisdiction.
Well, see, my whole base is behind this, and I'll show you where my own pet, you know, prejudices or something. I don't believe in really smoking that shit at all. See, and I throw this out, they can decide to, you know, shit that.
Well, we love to have more school fires. When I come from Canada, some of you know, and we used to smoke in plastic at school, at the university. And if you've ever sat around after somebody has been sitting on the floor and butts and all the crap all over the floor, which to me, and this was in the education building, and they were supposed to be teachers, and it happened all over. And I can see the students doing this too and making such a mess and probably lighting something on fire. And I know in Canada, they don't smoke. They just smoke outside the school, but not in the school for fire regulations. And we even had kids that smoked inside the school. Everyone smoked. It started to fire. It caused quite a commotion.
Yeah, well, since my one thing here is that, you know, I don't believe in teaching kids by telling them you do what I tell you to, and don't follow my example.
Well, I don't think they don't follow the example of putting butts on the floor and all the acid on the floor.
Well, why don't you go into chewing gum and eating, you know? Teachers are bringing coffee to classrooms, but yet I can't, you know, I can't have a second one.
See, as part of our physiology courses in high school, you teach the kids about the evils of drink and smoking, see? You know, but the kid's been taught this in this, you know, physiology class, and he gets out of the class, walks down the hall past the teacher's lounge, the door opens up and all the smoke pours out. I mean, this is senseless as far as I'm concerned.
You know? Yeah, but if you have some children, do you allow your children to smoke? I don't know, maybe you do.
I think your children as far as smoking and things like that, you're going to follow your own example, and I don't smoke, and I don't think my children how it would either too well.
Was it
if you don't want your children to smoke, they're going to smoke in school if they do not smoke.
I don't think this is a major concern of education, except that insofar as the whole idea, I mean, you know, we came out with this $1 million publication called Teaching Moral Values in the School, because, you know, that's a school responsibility now. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, if you're going to worry about whether or not, you know, minor things like dress standards and smoking and that kind of thing, that's one thing. I think it's a bigger thing is to worry about the school as an institution that does either teach the moral values that either the society wants them to teach. And in that case, they've got to worry about what kind of moral standards do the people whom they hire to teach, you know, what kind of moral standards do they have.
You can't teach morals to kids. They learn them at college.
Well, they learn them before they even go to school, but then that's, you can't tell the public that.
You don't do a thing. You don't even so much as scratch a surface.
Well, I said they learn them before they even go to school, before they hit kindergarten.
I thought it was illegal for you to teach moral standards.
Oh, no. We should see if you're supposed to be supposed to teach.
What kind of thing you teach?
Teaching is not an amoral activity, no matter what anybody says. Because any time that a teacher gets up in front of a classroom, he is an example to the students.
They're
of
very
action.
My experience.
Teaching is not an amoral activity.
My high school experience leads me to believe that there are very, very few teachers who are set up as examples by the students. I mean, they're just. The quality of the teachers that my classmates and I ran into during high school, you know, we just had no desire to idolize.
You idolize many teachers, but some of them were very great teachers, but at the time I didn't idolize them at all because I was a kid.
That's not necessarily true. That is, In fact, I'd say that that was untrue. Because I ran into very few great teachers. I had some good teachers, and I had one or two, you know, better than good. And very few below average, or quite a few below average during high school.
I was a little more fortunate.
Roger?
Witness.
What do you think are some of the solutions? Are there solutions in other countries, such as our neighbors to the north in Canada, or maybe in Europe, that are doing a better job of educating or training the teachers? We should end off.
Not necessarily. The University of Poodle was involved in $170,000 government program evaluating both education of teachers and also the elementary education of students in United States and selected communities at random and also in Great Britain and Wales. And this study brought out both studies brought out that really our students are better off in certain areas. The kids themselves are better off in certain areas than that. I don't know which the areas were right offhand, just quickly. But our students are better off in certain areas, and students in England and Wales are better off in other areas. They sort of balance each other, whereas the teacher preparation is better in the United States. My whole thing about the high schools was that I don't think, you know, you can't dictate down from the kids, you know, to the kids. They're not, you know. You can make them conform at school, but so what? They're going to do their, you know, school should be as much part of life as life is. Not something you have to conform to, you know, 6 hours a day.
There's a lot of things in life you have to conform to, whether you like it or not. I mean, if you're part of a city, you've got to conform to all the ordinances of a city and a state and a country. And you don't like it, but you gotta conform to it. I think just the other side of the coin, that they should learn that they just can't do anything they want to do because they don't like it.
Yeah, unreasonably though.
An interesting phase of education about, you know, that I think touches on this morality is just how much violence can a teacher direct towards his high school students? I mean, physical violence. This is something that's always intrigued me. I went to high school. Well, I was in a school system on the East Coast for 10 years, and I was never struck once by a teacher during that entire 10-year period. I moved to Minnesota, and I went to high school for 2 years. And I was struck 3 times the first year and once my second year. And I find it hard to believe that there was any great personality change in myself. You know, they required me to get 4 times in 2 years and 0 times in 10 years. I'm not sure. Perhaps at the East Coast is sufficiently sophisticated not to have to deal with their disciplinary problems with violence. That's one possible solution.
On the East Coast, I noticed that the students were a lot more respectful to teachers. Students would, for instance, open the doors for teachers. And a few other little courtesies of life that in the Midwest they wouldn't dream of doing. Maybe since the students were better behaved all up the East, they didn't need the discipline.
Well, you know what it is, partly, is the fact that our schools in the East and the West Coast happen to be a lot better, with sort of a general whole, if I can make a general statement, than they are in the Midwest. See, like along the East Coast, like from Washington, D.C. on up north, in the state of California, Oregon, and Washington, these schools are doing a lot of things, and they've tried a lot of things and thrown a lot of things out. But the schools in the Midwest don't even hear about them until 3 or 4 years later.
But you tell me
there is the respect of the people in the East for education that you don't necessarily have for teachers that you don't necessarily have in the Midwest. It's the same respect that you have in the parochial school systems, the Roman Catholic Church.
Don't ever try and tell that to a Midwestern administrator, like a principal, or even a Midwestern teacher, because they'll tell you that you're either a snob or completely wrong. You know, I mean.
I don't know how indeed that teacher is a little less. I think that there is a growing problem, a physical problem, not of all students, but of a very small majority of people who do disrupt classes. I don't think it's particularly in the Middle West. I think perhaps when you talk to teachers from all over, this is a growing problem, and it stems from the home.
Well, in my school system that I went to in New Jersey, I heard of, in 10 years, I heard of two cases where a teacher struck a student, and I feel that they're both justified. In one case, a student attacked the teacher, you know, and I feel, you know, personal offense, you know, and then in another example, the other case that I remember, a teacher or a student, you know, used profanity in front of a group of students to a male teacher, and I thought this was justified too, because you just, you know, you lose your respect for them. I mean, the students would.
And John, one of the most perceptive critics of the high school today, I think, was Edgar Friedenberg, The Vanishing Adolescent, Coming of Age American. He has argued that we do much more cruel things to the students than hitting them. In one place, he's even suggested that we might be better off returning to the old brutality of pain. But this respects the dignity of students much more than some of the things that we do very simply and kindly through our counseling and guidance, trying to manipulate his personality and really getting at it. Instead of, you know, a kid, Friedberg says, a kid does something bad, he breaks the window, and you, in the old days, you give him a one with cane. That's cruel. But some schools will call that student before the student tribunal. And there he will sit, and he will be disgraced. Maybe it's an open hearing. And he'll be told about how he's damaging school property. Then he'll be sent in for tests and counseling with the guidance counselor. Well, Friedberg argues very clearly that this is much more cruel than inhumane.
Yeah, I can see that, but,
you know,
in high school I went to in Minnesota, they didn't have a tribunal. You know, you got hit in the mouth by the teacher, or you were sent to the office, and if you had a buddy in the office, you know, you went into his office instead of going into the principal. And he sat around and said, look, Tony, you know, I got another bad deal, I think. Why don't you look at it objectively and go to bat for me if you think I deserve it? And if not, I'll go into the principal and tell him my story.
Don't you think that could happen at any city in the United States, except in the West?
Yeah, it probably could. You see, my point is, 10 years, zero violence directed at me. 2 years, 4 times I was hit. And I don't think I changed that much as a person.
No, but you could have been living in Mexico.
I never went to school in New Mexico, but I know a teacher there, and because of the influence of the Mexicans, I guess. And,
well, I just picked that up.
Yeah. And this is what she told me. I don't know.
Maybe they're stricter in the Midwest.
No, I don't think so.
I think state laws often differ on that, too. On punishment. Sometimes states do not allow a teacher to touch a child in any situation whatsoever, and other states do. So maybe that was the difference between New Jersey and Minnesota.
You know, when I was...
You can't touch a student in Minnesota anymore.
That was
a law.
Well, you see, when I went to high school in Minnesota, you know, even if there was a state law against a teacher striking a student, there was no way that the student and his family could press charge because of the legal system that the Board of Education has, the Minnesota State Board of Education has, to defend their teachers. I never tried, you know, it wasn't that big a deal to me. I mean, the first time I couldn't believe it, but, you know, my family didn't try and press charge or anything. But I was told that if I did try and press charges, that it was a hopeless case, and, you know, court cost would be directed towards myself, and, you know, the humility of losing a case to the Board of Education and things like this.
You came up under a different system. If I ever got in any trouble in school, I was promised double at home. You know, I would get at least that much.
By that, I take it to mean that you thought my parents were too liberal with me.
No, I say you came up in a different system. That's all I said. I said, well, if I got in trouble in school, I got a double at home.
What if your trouble at school was not justified by being hit in the mouth?
Well,
what if it could have been handled easily?
I never got one of these.
Well, you see, I never was hit either.
Well, that's your question. We can, I'm quite in, Justice Snyder, and go on to recommendation. I'd like to return here to Pauline's point about maybe sometimes with our concern for the total person, or going after the personality of an individual, we sort of overreact to situations. I haven't read the book, but I have read criticism similar to this, that I'm a student theorist in Minnesota. One of the things that the students are concerned with is whenever a student gets in trouble in the dormitory for any kind of breakage or starting a fight or anything like this, he's sent over to the dean of students' office, and the first thing that happens to him, he's given the Minnesota multi-faith personality inventory. And who's ever taken this test?
Everybody in Minnesota's taken it three times.
Yes, I had to take it so I could become a student there. And it's ridiculous.
And, graduate student, you know how to answer,
do you? Yes, graduate student education, so, and I've read some of the learning theory behind this test itself. And so I can tell, well, aha, here they're trying to see if I'm a paranoid, here they're trying to see if I'm a homo, and here they're trying to, you know. but my point is, I'm sort of backing up what Paul says. I think in some way this is more cruel, and it is worse. The schools are assuming a tremendous responsibility when they assume that they can mold each individual to whatever they want.
And I know on the East Coast they have done this. This is the sort of thing. I know our son had this sort of discipline. You said you weren't struck. Well, he wasn't either, but he was, what you said, he was. You know, I was called and parents were called and you got to do something to this child. Needs psychiatric help or something, you know, take him to the guidance counselor. Now, they didn't punish him, but they did that. And the poor kid was really in a disturbed state.
Well, but that's somewhat what Roger is getting at when we worry about long hair and short skirts and that. And it seems to me that these are some of the things that really are alienating high school students and college students from American education, are things like this. Instead of really helping those individuals, you're trying to force them into a little box.
You see
push
this
them through the system.
See this. I go to college in Minnesota too, at St. Paul, and you see this test is administered for, you know, just run of the mill breakage in the dormitory.
At University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
If you're ever sent to the dean of student office. That's the first thing that will happen to you.
So where do you stand? A lot of those standards, I guess.
By the way, this is going to change.
It seems to me that one of the big problems with at least the education that I know about is we alienate the public with this kind of argument. Look at those dead schools tolerating long hair and short skirts and blah, blah, blah. And then along comes a bond issue, and the public, you know, turns it down. And so therefore, the situation at school gets worse and worse because there's no money to do anything. And I don't know how East and Midwest handles the money problem, but I know that in my community, I teach in a very overly crowded high school. It has 4,600 students, and we try to keep them because the parents insist that they're there under our guidance. We've got to keep them locked in at lunch, and it's a mass of bodies. And, you know, so that we have more and more discipline problems and more people criticizing the school because of it, and therefore the next bond issue comes up. You know, I mean, it's just a hopeless case.
Yeah, it's really the spiral, yes.
Yeah.
And I think that there's got to be some kind of real awakening on the part of the general public in America, an interest in education, and really communication between parents and their kids.
You know, talking about bond issues, communication here. In most states, there's a state law that tax money cannot be spent to publicize in any manner or form or shape or what have you, the public school system. In other words, any brochure for a bond issue or any real publicity about your public school system either has to come through, you know, donations by individuals for one reason or another, or they have to come through sort of, you know, the graciousness of the local newspaper or television station, something like this, or that these media, you know, can find something newsworthy of, you know, a kid out of school because his hair is, you know, over his ears or something, or her skirt is 6 inches too short. You know, this is about, you know, the school system has, in a lot of places, no means to even communicate, because the state law has to say you can't spend public tax money on this communication. You can't, you know, publicize the public school system with tax money.
You don't want to change that, do you?
Well, in our system, we had newspapers that came out because I was one of the schools, the new schools on modular system, and a few of the parents were unhappy with the situation, and perhaps more were because the public relations had fallen down. And some parents, who, although they had been invited to come to school, hadn't. So the article came in the newspaper, but the people themselves paid to, they wrote the article, and paid, and burdened the price. Now you had to come in and explain the situation to the parents.
Yeah, I'm not getting kind of tired of that. That happens every year in Los Angeles. They come along and say, now we need your volunteer help and your money. And so what they do is they call a faculty meeting, and there we sit there until, you know, we've done some work to help advertise the bond issue. Nobody else works for it. The teachers who are sort of overworked anyway end up giving money and time to actually go out and knock on doors.
And nobody else, no other employee is required to pay money out of their own pocket to advertise for something, are they?
No.
And this is what we do. If we want something for special ed, we buy it ourselves, you know, or else you have a wrangle with the office. Get in hot water and then they don't tell you where you're going. So you just buy, you know, if you want something, you buy it. And just nobody else does this. You want a piece of paper, secretary wants a piece of paper, she doesn't have to go and buy it.
It's surely a dangerous principle to say that you want an organ of the state, which the school board is, to be allowed to spend tax money to influence the public. We want Johnson to spend our income tax to brainwash us in favor of the great society. That's a very dangerous principle. The state should not be using tax money to engage in propaganda.
But the federal government is.
Well, it shouldn't be. The federal government is doing it. You shouldn't know this. And you want to stop.
Don't you think that to influence people for education is without cost?
Yeah. But it's never that. You're never influencing people for education. You're influencing them for a particular program about which some of the people feel strongly negative. Otherwise, it wouldn't be necessary to influence.
Or to just to educate them for the fact that.
Educate them in the facts as the Board of Education sees it. You see, some boards of education are made up of incompetent and just misfits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's even vicious people.
But how else are you going to do this?
In Wenatchee, we have a citizens advisory board to the Board of Education or school board, five member school board, but they ran into this problem every year, the bond issue, because of the state of Washington's method of financing education. So they've, and the bond issues would fail. So they had started about 2 or 3 years ago a citizens advisory committee with interested people in the community taken part in them. The last 2 years, the bond issues have passed because they were needed, and this committee had had a chance to sit through the things, and they would pair the budget or advise the board to pair the budget. This has been real successful in our community.
Then what happens? I mean, the committee.
The committee raises money, like for the PR that you're talking about, to whether you're, they're normally for, they're kind of supporting the issue, and they ask other people in the community to donate money, which is what it's called, to pay for ads. But they get a lot of volunteers to do this too.
Wouldn't this be a good job for the PTA? They don't seem to be doing much else. Or aren't there any PTAs anymore?
Well, you know, the PTA is an awful subversive organization in some sections of the country. There are, if you're not aware of it, there are certain cities in this country, a number you can call and get a John Birch Society sponsored little spiel on the PTA. The John Birch Society feels that the PTA is quite a radical organization.
Roger, there's an example. Dallas, I'm from Dallas, Texas, and last year we had a beautiful example of what we're talking about right now. The school board, Dallas has no kindergartens, and it also has very few funds to any special education project. A lot of the special things, like say they want a curtain for the gymnasium, or some special remedial materials, or some tools maybe helpful in teaching new math. This is gotten, I know, by contributions from parents, usually through the PTA, which means, of course, that the kids in the low-income neighborhood who probably most needed in materials don't get them at all. Well, the school board and the establishment of the city was in favor of this system. They talked about these things many times, and you know, the name of neighborhood autonomy, and I don't know why they didn't have kindergarten, but Dallas certainly has enough money. Well, the state of Texas doesn't pay for it, so Dallas wasn't going to do it on their own. Now, here was the administration, the school board, all of the powers of education, who some of you apparently think are good guys, fighting against this. And a private citizens group was established. It took them about 2 years to get enough power to lead for educational advancement in Dallas. And they, just this last spring, finally got control of the school board. And it would have been impossible, I'm sure, if the school board had been allowed by law to use tax money in the propaganda campaign, as well as they had plenty of money.
Yeah, well, you know, just talking about Texas, if you have a problem in the state of Texas, the textbooks used in the state of Texas are approved by a commission of who knows what on a statewide basis. In other words, the textbooks, if they're used in Dallas or Fort Worth or anything else, has been approved by a small member committee, and the book written by two people at Harvard called Censors in School, and brings this out very good about, you know, how the particular group was influenced and left or right, I forget which way they were going, but and they were editing all the materials that came into the state this way. In other words, the local school boards didn't have any say really over what textbooks they were using if they were not on the approved list of the state. This is true in a number of places. But there is a small committee controlling the textbooks that they use. There's also talking about textbooks. There are some textbook companies that have given up publishing textbooks in the South, are trying to sell their textbooks in the South because they are now getting around to the point that it's more profitable, you know, to include pictures of Negroes and things in the textbooks, and they still are not profitable in the South. Textbook companies are all out of the money. Or they print what they call a Miss Jewel edition. In other words, you know, in the South it'll be two white children, in the Northern edition it'll be a white and a Negro child, something like that. There's something we should, I think, there's a problem you should watch in education, as parents, or anybody else considered, is that most of the textbook companies are now owned
by other large corporations. Xerox, ICA, Victor, IBM, and Minnesota MMM, Minnesota Mining and Wood Manufacturing, they all now own different textbook companies. And their influence is going to be felt in education also.
And they're involved a little bit more than that. The big corporations are just now beginning to be involved in curriculum development and learning theory. They are, the big corporations are beginning to be all set up so they can say, we'll sell you a school system, you know. We'll furnish the building and the curriculum, and, you know, this is the way it's going to operate. And so, I mean, a whole package deal, not just books. They're in the business of establishing curriculum and materials that go with these curriculums and how it's supposed to operate and work.
Yeah, Time Life, whose textbook subsidiary is Silver Verdeck, has been merged with a group, the educational subsidiary of General Electric, I think it is, and they now have an organization called General Learning, I think it's called, and they're coming out with this. You know, they can supply a school system with, you know, from kindergarten or nursery school, line up through junior community college level, you know, textbooks, everything. Overhead projectors, maps, you name it, you know. They can sell you the whole world. They can have a package deal. And it can be, you know, this may be a good thing, and again, it may not.
I get the feeling that in Scholastic magazines, I don't know how national this is, I have a feeling.
Somebody owns that too, I don't know.
Yeah, but they have practically taken over the junior high English curriculum, and you don't have to be an English major to teach English in junior high now. All you do is you become a secretary that whips off this is lesson 1A, rip, and you pass that out. You have to be a fantastic secretary, but you don't have to know anything except be able to keep track of all these things. And I have this really growing fear that this is a tendency toward the teaching machine. Total curriculum teaching machine, and I don't know what's going to happen to the teacher. Maybe this is what is coming to me, maybe it's good.
This is freeing the teacher for the things that you can't do by rote memory, for discussion and understanding, or for pinpointing specialized problems, so that the teacher doesn't have to do the routine mechanized things that the machines can do far better than the teacher can do.
When you get into a novel, let's say, you know, and it's all canned for you, I'm sorry, I just don't accept Scholastic magazine's interpretation of whatever book they're doing right now.
Well, maybe I don't even like it. Shouldn't have to either.
No, I
when I worked as a teacher's aide, all the major textbooks, you know, they have what they call dittos, or well, our newspaper, which is all around here, you know, was around on a ditto. You can buy these things by the boxes, you know, they're about 3/4 inch thick. And who knows, I don't know, 200, maybe 300 of them in a box. And I see teachers in the morning, the teachers, they go in and they put these on and run them all off. They're running off like mad. You know, and I say to the teacher, I says, well, you know, what are you doing this for? Well, yeah, the kids have to have something to do. I says, well, how long does it take a kid to do one? They go, well, 4 or 5 minutes, you know. And they pass them on another one. But see, this was made by a textbook company who's trying to sell something to how many millions of kids throughout the country. Yeah. This isn't going to meet every individual. This may meet some of the kids' needs, but it isn't going to meet all of them.
I tell you, you better go down and you teach primary kids. And these are a blessing. I mean, now I teach 5 reading books a day. And I tell you, when I have a lesson that is made up on, say, on phonics that I just taught, it saves me a lot of work if I can go and find a ditto sheet with the same stuff that I've just taught rather than make it up myself. You know how long it takes to make that and draw all those pictures for a primary?
Why have you taught phonics?
I teach phonics.
Everybody? All your students need it?
No. I don't teach the whole 12 of them phonics.
Well, how?
I teach three or four. Students. And then give them a lesson on.
Yeah, well, you.
Well, what if she's all about your teaching, because you only have 12 students.
I teach mentally handicapped and intentional ones. And these are a blessing for primary teachers, because they're made out to need to go and flip through and find one that's applicable to what you're okay.
What you're doing, but now she was talking about Scholastic magazine. They put out a nice little reading test. And people as parents, you know, the kids may bring this test home, and it says he got a certain score. What does this tell you? It doesn't tell you one damn thing. It doesn't tell a teacher one damn thing. All she knows is he's got some kind of a score on that. She doesn't know if he's having problems with initial consonants, if he's having problems with long vowels, problems with who knows what. She doesn't know that at all. All she knows is that she's sent home with you. The kid has done well or he's done badly. You don't know why, the teacher doesn't know why.
Why not? They're kind of shitty, so you can gather something by looking over a test sheet back there.
I think the crux of the issue is that I think all teachers would have to say with her that the new teaching materials are good time savers, which teachers have an only enough need. But at the same time, they aren't substitutes for good teaching.
Well, it's the idea when they come out and they say, all right, you're going to teach this Scholastic package for the first 6 weeks, and then you're going to get phase two, and that's this, you know. There's nothing left, you know, and you feel like, well, I've got to get through with this, these ripping, all I do is rip sheets off. there's nothing left. You know, there's nothing left for you to do. And what good is my education? For that, I didn't even need a college education. For that, all I needed was a secretary's thumb thing.
But the new curriculum is very greatly on the amount of structure and implementation they have. I know there are several new history curriculums, or social studies curriculums. Some of them are just for high school, or some for two grades, some of them for junior high and high school. But one of them comes to mind is Carnegie Institute of Technology is putting out a new history curriculum. And by the way, one of the things they say in their critique or their summary of what they're trying to do is they say that they're not trying to teach any kind of moral value. But when you take a look at this curriculum and you see what they've selected for the kids to read, they're teaching moral values, you know. But anyway, what this is, each day the teacher is given a plan and the kids are given so many things to read, and then it says, tells the teacher, you ask this question, you will probably get this answer. Then you ask this question, you will get this answer. You ask this question, you will get this answer. Well, here's a place where it's really regimented. Well, then the University of Minnesota also has a curriculum that's designed for K-12. But in their high school level, they read a much wider variety of materials. Different reading levels are taken into consideration, from average to above average. So far, there's nothing for the below average. But we're working on that. There is not this canned question, answer type thing. A teacher is given a general outline, and she is expected to pick and choose what material they think will fit the students that they are teaching. They pick out of a whole list of objectives, what objectives they want to teach. So really, a curriculum like this does a lot of looking up, a lot of library work really for the teacher. Tells her where he or she can go to find it. And a lot of things that are out of print books and things that they've been able to get permission to put in the public domain, you know, so they can be run off by anybody on a mimeograph, are set up so students will have these available to read.
You teachers are running down the propaganda that is widely distributed by these textbook companies and Scholastic magazine. But what I would tend to run down is a teacher has a completely captive audience for 60 minutes. And in 60 minutes, you know, once a day, he can indoctrinate these students you know, in any direction he wishes. And this is, this would be my major complaint about junior high school, not so much in college, but, no, really.
I disagree.
Well, to a lesser degree.
Maybe 3 hours.
Because I always, in high school, I could, or my friends and I could, you know, if these things were, if these published materials were this, you know, if they were oriented this to such a degree that, you know, that it was noticeable, you know, we just kind of tend to disregard them. But a teacher can, you know.
That's why I would argue that a college teacher can really have more influence simply because they know so much more than you do, and so much more, well, that's a different problem.
I'm using the reading quite a bit, interesting study. I can't document it too well, but this fellow studied the readers used in the first three primary years in this country for a century, and they're claimed to be able to determine what college students' attitudes toward violence are by analysis of the readers in the first three primary years. And we've done it for some time. Now, this seems like it could be quite possible, whether he's done it or not. Is another story, but if you're going to have huge big corporations publishing all the textbooks, you know, from kindergarten through college, and then you know you're out on the lawn, they also publish a news magazine and stuff like this. I think that we have a real thing.
Yeah, and so that's why I think that teachers have a responsibility when you look at these new curriculums to pick and choose what is the best for each of them. Scholastic magazine, I'm sure, has a few things that are good about it. But why does a teacher have to follow their instructions explicitly? Why can't she say, well, this one I'm going to rip out and throw in the wastebasket?
Well, this is something that's bothering me. They're sitting here listening to the people say that you rip off sheets and things like this and use them. Now, there are some things that we naturally use, but I don't have to teach any particular thing.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You can pick and choose.
The most important thing to me is how a child studies a subject. And I would ask any student to read not one book on a subject, but several books on a subject, at least three, before he gives an opinion. Because if you read one book and just restates an opinion of one person, and he just gets information in place. For instance, I'll say the very best resource at this time to be this is probably your parents, or listen to the local newspaper, or radio station, or any one of these things, and then form your opinion. And they don't have to be the same as mine. I will, however, if somebody states an opinion which I feel that they've read something wrong, ask them where they got their information, and I'll say, well, I wonder if you've misread it. And sometimes they'll say, well, I read it again. I said, why don't you get it and reread it again? And the next day, they'll come back and say, you know, I did reread it, and I missed on it. I got one boy on a report, and finally he said, when I asked to bring the book in, he said, oh, I took it off the top of my head. It's a responsibility to the students. I feel that I have a right to have them say, well, I got it from this book from this author.
Well, I think, let me say first that being a former junior high school teacher, I tend to exaggerate. I exaggerated my participation in ripping off pages. But let me also say that when Scholastic Magazine comes out with its marvelous packages and school boards say they're really great and buy them, pretty soon, at first you have a choice. Yeah. Then your textbooks, tend to wear out, get thrown away. You've got your set that dwindles so that you can no longer use it for the class. And what's left is Scholastic Magazine. Then what do you do? You have.
Well, see, then I think it's time for the teachers to start going to the school board and let them know what they want. And let the school board say what they want, and then somehow work out a solution to it.
Well, in California, isn't it a statewide thing that the state
They actually print the textbooks, don't they?
Some of them, in junior high, a lot of the state textbooks are used as doorstops in the textbook room. And then they go to the other, you know, the other ones. The couple of the history books.
But they, you are allowed to use other.
Oh, yeah.
Besides the.
Besides Rafferty's books, I mean.
Yeah, besides Rafferty's books.
Twice it's come up that people have expressed concern about large corporations requiring control of publishing firms. And I'd like to point out something on the other side. This may, in fact, be a better textbook and less opinionated textbook for these reasons. In the first place, I've worked for and in and around a number of publishing firms, including two large ones that have been taken over. And one thing, there's tremendous lack of communication, not only between the parent company and the publishing firm, but frequently within the various departments of the publishing firm. There is McGraw-Hill, for example, this one that IBM owns, SRA. They are not controlled by parent corporation. Parent corporation has the foggiest notion of what they're doing. Then, moreover, many of these corporations pick these up as sort of prestige items in their dressing. They are not particularly interested in making a profit, but they want to have a publishing house. And it's usually the publisher who benefits from this arrangement. Most publishers do not make money. And the corporation pumps in some money and gives them a great deal more freedom. What is too likely to happen when we have a lot of publishing firms that are scrimping and scrounging, trying to get by, is that they are going to cater to the least common denominator. And we get worse heads to a moral opinion. Of course, these firms now have got a little freedom to experiment, try out on gardening, and actually publish competing textbooks, sometimes radically different outlooks. And they only actually have salesmen out in the field who are fighting against one another. I think this is good. I think we should watch it. I'm all suspicious of business and large corporations and require too much control. But wait, I don't want to pull off half cocked here. Let's look at this. Look at what happens.
Well, I think, though, that the basic point is the publishers do have some influence on curriculum. This is valid. Simply because my advisor is head of the social studies curriculum project at Minnesota. And every now and then I go in to see her, she's complaining about what the textbook manufacturers have done now, what they've cut out, or what they've decided to include, something that she had nothing to do with.
Isn't it her prerogative then to
if she wants to get it published, why she has to, you know, these are some of the things that she has to work out with that.
Well, I think that the world has changed so fast today that in order to keep a book up, it's very difficult. And school systems usually buy books. Well, I shouldn't say this, but often they say a textbook is saved for 5 years in order to keep the taxpayers' money within a limit where they can spend consumption. When 5 years, the world is changing so fast that the materials, though. And in many cases, I think the paperback volumes that are coming out of cheaper editions
need to be. Madison Wesley in their mass series is not coming out with paperback editions in 1960s. The eight editions are in paperback form, and there's not no other hardcover.
What is the White House conference? Is that a committee of educators and parents and teachers? And is it national? Try to do something about education, and doesn't the whole problem have to go back to what your state, even your education departments in the university, are manipulating so intelligent at the colleges across the district. And I think this is where a lot of the big problem is, that we don't get the right kind of teachers because of the demands of the education departments. They think their subject is the most important. And consequently, kids who are going out as teachers don't even get time to study the thing they're going to teach, but you have to take education courses, which are irrelevant many times and impractical. And I think that they have to start from here, that somebody has to jump in on education in the university.
This is true of some schools, but like, I have my teacher training at Pearson, Nebraska. And out of the 125 credits I have 23 in education and 8 of those are student teaching.
Yeah, but those people go teach college today with no education, but if you're going to teach first grade, you have to have all these hours.
Yeah, but of course, that elementary education now is separate. That's about all.
They have a lot of pressure on themselves to demand this sort of thing. And this is where I think White House Conference and we as a voting public ought to have something to do with people who go to White House Conference to change these things.
Yeah, well, I think, as I said before, there's got to be a real concern on the part of parents as what is going on in their schools.
We're back to the, how you're going to communicate to the parents.
That's right. And there's a real responsibility of the teachers to, and the schools to do this communicating.
Roger? I've got a question that's entirely different from what the subject has been discussing. I noticed in Australia and New Zealand that the children in public schools wear uniforms, which is required. This eliminates this social competition. I was wondering what this group would think of this, maybe in their community. Or...
We wear uniforms in our high schools too.
Except in New York?
Well, I mean all over, especially in suburban high schools. It's just that the uniform is decided by most of the school administrators don't necessarily say what the uniform is, but high school students do wear uniforms.
The kids, the Catholic kids, believe it or not, and the girls' schools all wear uniforms.
My daughter goes to school and she wears uniforms. Last year, she was in eighth grade and she complained terribly about every day. She complained about the uniform. So I thought, I just couldn't stand it. This year, she has not complained about it once and she's in ninth grade. Same uniform.
This is an eighth grader.
Yeah. Same uniform exactly. It didn't change. She'll complain about the uniform. Probably. Yeah.
But you know what I feel about uniforms is that you said that. You know, eliminate the social pressure and competition.
And the drain on the parents' pocket.
Well, yes. Don't you think that when we get out in the world, we have these social pressures? And if we don't learn to curb them in school and when we're younger, it's going to be awfully hard when we get out. Because, I mean, you have maybe someone in the next desk who dresses like $1 million and you can't afford it. Well, you have to curb your desire to go out and buy the most expensive clothes and maybe spend the next 6 months paying for one dress or something. You have these pressures. And I think I'm awfully afraid that we're going to create a sort of a little fairy story for the children in school. When they get out, it's different. Up in Canada, it's the greatest thing. Never let the child get bored. It's entertaining every second he's there. But when they get out in the world, they're not going to be entertained.
But the thing I noticed is that I think it kind of starts down the junior high level in our area where young people are going shopping every night after school. I would think that it's costing their parents quite a bit of money. Maybe I know it's across the street. My neighbor's daughters, I think Barbara's mentioned they have an outfit for every day for at least 2 weeks.
I think a lot of this is, you know, from the kids, but also from the parents. I mean, you know, you get, because in high school, you know, they have a formal, you have to have a white dinner jacket to go to the formals and things like this, whereas in college, you know, you know each other, you know, forget it, you know, you spend that kind of money. I think a lot of, we have an awful lot of pressure, especially from mothers, to make their kids grow up, you know. Mommy's out buying the daughter who no more needs it than man on the moon, you know, a bra, and you know, they're pushing, you know, social dancing in the sixth and seventh grade, you know, and the parents also push, you know, graduation from kindergarten, graduation from elementary school to junior high, you know.
It's true.
This is where your parent teacher organization could be something other than it is. I don't belong to the haters as a teacher, I hate it as a parent. I don't waste time to spend the whole afternoon deciding when you're going to buy 6 cups for the kids. But after having taught this past year, I thought if they only knew how much help a teacher needed, if they would become a service organization and come down and help the teachers and take out some of these problem children who really need help and didn't need help. If they came out, took one child out for an hour and really gave him special attention, they'd be helping their own children in school. And I think if we could go back with this idea to your own local PTA, you might get something worthwhile developed.
I remember when I was...
You could also bring in a social problem in this same way.
This is being done using...
Or just let a parent-teacher organization lead this something by not liking it.
But this is what Paul is speaking about. You know, you have a problem child and you recognize that he has a problem. And so, all right, say a fifth hour, we recognize this child has a problem. So fifth hour, he goes to another school to meet with a class that all have this problem. I remember when I was in junior high school.
I didn't mean it as bad as a problem. If he's I can cite you an example. I was teaching fourth grade and had three kids in each section I had who absolutely couldn't read a word. Not even pre-print. What do you do with them when they get to fourth grade? You can't have them sit in color. If one of those parents had been interested enough to come down and pick a child up, because he was personally interested, I don't know whether he taught him, hey, carving, but showed this child somebody likes me, because these children were not retarded. They were not necessarily a problem, but they were not learning. There was a barrier there. I didn't have time to help them, and where I was working with them, I was cheating the good kids. And I think parents would realize how much they could have helped in this respect to give this child who maybe needed love, just somebody to take time out to help him where he hadn't gotten, what might eliminate a lot of these other problems.
But my point is, when you remove one or two individuals from a specific class dealing with a specific subject, it is not extremely difficult for the remainder of his peers to realize that this kid is, you know, kind of out of it.
Well, should I let him go on for 16 years
until he comes out? John, if the kid can't read, they know it anyway.
Yeah, the kid knows. And it's that he gets some special time and maybe the world of good for him. May the best thing that happened.
We had cases like this when I was in junior high, and these people were ostracized by their, you know, this kid was being removed for two or three classes a day to get special help. Now, granted, you know, he has to have help, you know, extra help at some time, but I question whether he should, you know, every fourth hour, Monday,
right,
Wednesday,
he's not allowed to stay in school 5 minutes after school. My kids had to be out of the building. Parents did not approve of keeping him. Well, where do you help a special child?
He's probably going to be ostracized anyway, whether he got help or not. Because the kids know a dumb kid. They know them.
I know there are a lot of private tutors available at
it costs $9 an hour.
You can scoff, but I question whether removing a kid from a classroom situation, every day really helps the guy.
What if you have a parent who won't give the tutor? Yeah. He says that with it.
Myself, the teacher, I wouldn't get an ulcer over the situation if the child's parents were not interested.
Somebody has to be
concerned about the child.
Looking at this objectively, the lady over there just said that the kid needs to be shown love in some cases, and that she'd like to take them out and show love. Well, then, when you take a kid out like this, for example, in second grade, we had reading groups A, B, and C. A was smart, C was dumb, A kid, British kid was C kid. Well, I mean, when your kid grows up, what kind of love is he going to get with the rest of the kids? Or ridiculing him because he's deaf. I mean, that's the way things go.
But see, even if you don't have these separate groups, the smart kids are going to know the dumb kids anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's why I said objective.
So they're going to get ridiculed anyway.
But being recognized by your own peers as being stupid is easier to take than when the teacher singles you out as being below par, in front of the rest of your class.
Yeah, but you don't realize how frightened those kids are. And when they sit in that class, he's terrified that she's going to call on them to read. I don't think you understand as much about these kids.
I had a
friend
whose folks took him out every night. He couldn't read a word. His folks took him out every night to the drag race. This is what they didn't care. He was tired when he came to school. I thought if I could only appeal to this child in one way, okay, we'll make a reader about the drag racing car, which is what I spent my nights doing, making a reader that I would get on the I thought, well, who knows about drag racing? Look, Mark, I was buying hot red rock magazine.
Elementary level, we may not have had the problem.
Because you're talking about junior, second grade.